As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the chosen one must be lifted up, so that everyone who believes will have enduring life. Yes, God so loved the world as to give the firstborn one so that whoever believes may not die. God sent the firstborn into the world not to condemn the world, but that through that one the world might be saved. Whoever believes in that one avoids judgment, but whoever refuses to believe is judged already for not believing in the firstborn of God. And so on these grounds, the sentence is pronounced, that though light has come into the world, people showed that they preferred darkness to the light because their deeds were evil. Indeed, those who do wrong hate the light and avoid it for fear their actions might be exposed. But those who seek to live by the truth come out into the light so that what has been done in God may be plainly seen. Well, you can see how the passage from the Hebrew Scriptures and the passage from the New Testament are closely related to one another this week in the lectionary readings that we were given. It says right here, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the chosen one be lifted up. I was blessed to have Jerry join me. He kind of babysat me in the hospital as I was having a procedure done on Tuesday. And Jerry was introducing me to a book that someone in the congregation shared with him. It's a book called Me, Myself, and Us by Brian Little. The Science of Personality and the Art of Well-Being is the subtitle of that book. And Jerry was sharing with me a passage out of the preface, and it rang true to my mind, funny, I thought, so I thought I'd share it with you all. From the preface, it says this: why can I motivate my employees but can't connect at all with my kids? Why am I a completely different person at home from the person I am at work? Do I really control the things that matter to me? I seem to be uncommonly happy. Is there something wrong with me? Is there any truth to the ludicrous rumor that I am, in essence, a jerk? So this book is about understanding ourselves better, and understanding ourselves better and understanding how we relate or don't relate to people is something that we all seem to be interested in, and I'm very glad about that. It's been my experience that people who gather in churches are particularly interested in the question, who am I? And who am I really? And how am I relating to people? And how am I relating to them really? What really constitutes my relationships with people? And it's because we're interested in those questions that we gather and we intentionally ask ourselves these questions over and over again in weekly meetings and small groups and all that sort of thing. But what does any of that have to do with today's Bible passage? John 3:16, you know, we've heard that so many times, and if you've turned your TV on lately, it's something that sometimes you see colorfully printed on the heads of people in football stadiums. Obviously, it's important to a lot of people, but it's one of those passages that is chronically misunderstood, and I think it's misunderstood so widely because it's just blatantly ripped up out of its context in the book of John, and it has been used as a way for frontier revivalist preachers and their progeny to insinuate that if you don't believe that Jesus died on your behalf to appease an angry God who really was intending to throw you into eternal hellfire, you might as well just count yourself among the damned. I'm not entirely clear that that's the purpose of this passage, though. If you read the actual Bible text, you'll see that that's not really what the passage is setting out to say. Rather, Jesus, John says, was going to be lifted up on the cross in the same way that the bronze snake was lifted up in the desert. Says that right in the passage. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the chosen one must be lifted up, so that everyone who believes will have enduring life. So the natural interpretive move that one would tend to make reading that passage would be to ask, why was the bronze snake lifted up in the wilderness? Because we figure, if we can figure out why the bronze snake was lifted up in the wilderness, it gives us a clue as to how John's understanding Jesus being lifted up on the cross and that being salvific for us. That's a really interesting question to me, and that's why kind of reading the Bible is kind of like solving a puzzle in a way. It engages your imagination and asks you to think creatively about the connections that people are making as they make these statements. So go back to the Numbers story, and it's an interesting story. Obviously, the view of God that is assumed by the author and redactor of the book of Numbers is not necessarily a view of God that many of us hold today. You know, a lot of us in this congregation are more influenced by the view of God that was part of the evolution of the Judeo-Christian tradition, that God is love. And many Jews and Christians sort of tend towards that view of God today rather than the one that's in this book that kind of assumes that God is up there waiting to send angry snakes on anyone who disobeys the law. But it's an interesting story nonetheless, and it has real meaning even for John. John, again, is a person who really emphasized that God is love and that love is the center of the gospel. So the passage shows the people coming out of slavery into the promised land. That's the meta narrative. And halfway there, people start getting disgruntled because they think, hey, this food isn't very good. Don't have enough of it. Actually, it was better in Egypt. There's no water here. This stinks. And you can imagine one person saying, you know, okay, so we got food, but it's not really good. And another person saying, yeah, you're right, it's not very good. There's no water. Yeah, there's no water. There's no water anywhere. Why are we? We're out in the middle of the desert and there's no water. And it spreads like wildfire. You can imagine the discontent spreading like a disease throughout the group. And so God sends, according to the story, snakes. Snakes arrive and they start biting people and they start dying. And they come back to Moses and they say, you know, obviously there's a plot here to overthrow Moses. Let's get rid of Moses, then we can go back to Egypt where we know there's at least, you know, some weeds that we can eat regularly for our diet. They say to Moses, tell God to take away the snakes. And interestingly, God doesn't take away the snakes. Now, what does God do in this Numbers passage? This is really funny. There's a little bit of humor here. God says, fashion a snake and put it on top of a pole. And then whoever was bitten by that snake, if they look at it, they'll live. What's the point of that? It's really interesting, isn't it? In this Old Testament story, this Hebrew story, ancient story, the only way people could really be healed was to look square in the eye at the brokenness they had created by their division and aggression. There was no way of being healed besides looking it in the eye and saying, that's us, snakes. Now, it's interesting to think about the question, what was healing about the snake? Looking at the snake as a way of forcing people to fess up to their propensity for division and aggression. The snake is a mirror. That's us, snakes. And until you see yourself in the mirror, you don't get healed. What is healing about the injustice and tragedy of Jesus' death? John makes the comparison here that the snake in the wilderness is sort of like Jesus being lifted up on a cross. John says that Jesus lifted up on the cross is a mirror. When we see Jesus on the cross, we see there a good person, a loving person, a peace-seeking person, a justice-seeking person, a truth-telling and reconciliation seeking person who was mercilessly executed on a cross as if he were some kind of criminal or threat or nuisance to the public good. We see in Jesus on the cross the broken world that we have created. We see it for what it really is. When we see Jesus on the cross, we have to look ourselves square in the eye as a people and to recognize our tragic tendency towards division and aggression when we feel threat and fear. The message of this text is that there's no healing in the wilderness until we can be honest with ourselves about who we really are and what we're really doing to each other. And this is very important for us as a nation, of course, and as a species on our perilous planet, to look into the mirror and to see what's really going on with us. But it's also important for us personally, and this is the sort of focus of today's service, is for us personally, when we find ourselves in the wilderness of interpersonal conflict and challenges, what is it that's our tendency? As I was saying in the children's time, when we're in conflict, are we really aware of what we're doing all the time? Or do we do the same thing that happens when these people in the middle of the wilderness experience threat and danger and fear? And we jump into some reactivity that creates division and aggression. When we're in conflict, do we look into the mirror and see what we're doing? Or do we not? In the Old Testament text today, remember that big picture was that we're moving from slavery to freedom. But people didn't see that. What they saw was danger and threat and fear. No water, no food. The need for security causes them to go into autopilot and to do exactly what humans always do when we face danger and fear and threat, which is to self-protect. And the evolutionary mechanism we have for this is awesome. This has served us well. If I'm walking through the savanna and there's a tiger over to the left of me that starts growling in the bush, and I am unprotected and I see that thing, my first instinct is to go, right? Because I know it's him or me. And so self-protective mechanisms are great, evolutionarily speaking, but in terms of our relationship, they're not great. They actually serve to do us harm, because that immediate mechanism to self-protect, to neutralize the threat, to get rid of the danger, to get rid of what it is that's causing me grief, get rid of Moses and we can go back to Egypt. Get rid of Jesus and we can overthrow the government like we want. Get rid of Jesus and we can fundamentalize religion people into heaven like we want, as the Pharisees were saying. Get rid of Jesus and we can quit these people gathering in groups and get them back to enjoying the status quo like we want, like the temple people would have said. Neutralize the threat. Get rid of the danger. The retort, the response to go straight into anger and self-righteousness and blame and aggression is very strong for us. And that's why it's easy for relationships to crack apart and for people to spiral out of control and away from each other in times of fear or threat. Pema Chodron once said, "One of the sad things about us humans is that, strangely enough, when we feel threatened or fearful, when we're really seeking peace and security, we go to war." That's really true. Unfortunately, we want to neutralize the other that we perceive as the threat. Think about partner A who expresses to partner B in a conversation, "You know, it's been a long winter, and I think we ought to commit to exercising a little bit more this year." Partner B dismissively replies, "Well, has that ever worked? We say that every year, and we don't do anything different." And partner A feels that little tightening. In Tibetan Buddhism, they call this shimpa. It's that moment where you get hooked by the feeling of tightening, that responsiveness, the feeling of hurt or threat of being disrespected. And it can sometimes lead to partner A, if partner A is verbally aggressive, and some people aren't verbally aggressive, they're passively aggressive, but if you're verbally aggressive, partner A might say something like, "Well, then just stay 20 pounds overweight then, see if I care." And then partner B gets hooked. And partner B, if partner B is verbally aggressive, might say something like, "Well, if you'd quit serving nothing but white bread and meat and cheese at every meal you make, we might not be 20 pounds overweight." Now you got a real fight on your hands. You got a major fight. It's because of this tendency that we have to self-protect, to react, to get hooked in that way, and to unthinkingly, without even seeing ourselves in the mirror, seeing what we're actually doing, to just move into reactivity and division and aggression. Snakes. When we encounter hurt or fear or threat, nature teaches us, right, to self-protect, to not be analytical, to not be self-aware. And so we forget that we have choices. And the path of least resistance is to react instinctively, either with passive or active aggression. There's a pretty clear pattern about how this works. There's that tightening, that getting hooked, and then we other the other person. That person's not like me anymore. They're other. And then we move into self-righteousness. The other is not only other, but the other is worse than me. Then anger, then blame, then aggression. And Pema Chodron, who was the person who gave us that wonderful quote about when we feel like we need peace and security, we often go to war, says that there's a way of avoiding that, and she calls it the middle way, the way of compassionate abiding, to stay with, when you feel that tightening, and you know you're starting to get hooked, to try to recognize, snakes, snakes, right? And to say, I'm not going to get hooked here. I'm going to abide in this feeling of discomfort. She says, it feels like you have your feet in the fire because you're not resolving the issue. What we want to do is we want to resolve it. We want to resolve that discomfort by solving the problem. But she says, it's good to choose not to move beyond that place for a while, to be patient, to abide in that place compassionately, to try to reengage our curiosity about the other or our humor or our playfulness, which we often lose as soon as the hook gets taken. And as I was thinking about that, I was thinking, you know, there's another way too, and that's the way of righteousness, which is even better than the middle way. And not only not to bite the hook, but to really develop a discipline to, when we feel that feeling of tightening, to try to thoughtfully determine what need is lying behind the other person's comment that moved us towards feeling like we were hooked, because there always is. The truth of the matter is that we're not that much different than other people, and often our needs are the same. So when partner B says, well, that has never worked, we say that every year and we don't do anything different. Instead of that instant reactivity, when we feel that tightening, it might have been useful to have paused and have tried to hold up a mirror to self and to other and say, what is that person really saying? Could it be that that person is saying, I'm really vulnerable to feelings of failure, and I don't think I can fail at this one more time? That might be what the mirror is saying. And if we know what the mirror is saying, if what reality is saying to us, then we can see that that need is something that is also a need of mine. And what's driving that comment is actually something that I can touch. There's a soft place there that's the same as a soft place I have. That there's a reality behind those words and actions that can provide a way for me to live into some solidarity. And instead of replying, well, then let's just stay 20 pounds overweight then, a creative response might be something like, well, hey, I know what you're feeling, and it's been an uphill struggle for me too, but I'm willing to give it another shot. John 3:16 is an interesting passage, isn't it? You know, painted on people's foreheads, you know, the cameras panning at the football game. It is a sort of a sign of salvation, though, and it's an important verse. God so loved the world as to give the firstborn one so that whosoever believes may not die. Believes in what? Believes in snakes. 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 Right? You have to see the snakes. And if we see the snakes, we don't die. I think it is indeed a text that explains how we become saved. So for me, being saved is not a matter of believing that Jesus died on my behalf to appease some angry God. Rather, I see John's point here as valid, that the cross of Christ can help save us because it's a mirror, that it shows us what we do to each other when we're threatened and fearful and hurt. We crucify each other. We go to war. Even the other that really, whether we know it or not, is deep down inside, in solidarity with us, we go to war. The cross of Jesus can help save us precisely because if we come into the light of truth about ourselves and about others, and if we live by that truth and come into that light, the very clear light shown to us in that mirror, that's precisely when we have enduring life, and that's when our relationships develop an enduring life, and our world through the light and life of that mirror of truth, is truly saved. Let's pray. Being with others in the world can sometimes be difficult, we confess, oh God. And others have not always developed the skills that make it easy for us to live amongst them. And so it's difficult to be called into that more disciplined lifestyle that de-escalates rather than escalates conflict. It's difficult for us. And so we need help. We pray for help that we might keep our feet in that fire long enough to find the soft spot that lies behind our relationship with others, that we might all be healed. Amen.